This is Women's Stories and Women's Voices on Yin Radio. Thanks for joining me today for an encore production of Yin Radio. This is The Father of the Telescope. It's going to come to us from last year, right about this same time, right near Father's Day. Enjoy this show with me. Welcome to Yin Radio. I'm your host, Sandy Billings. Today, we're getting ready for Father's Day with a somewhat topical show. It's called Father of the Telescope. This is from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. And our theme today, the Father of the Telescope. Now, that is Galileo Galilei, who first turned an eyepiece to the heavens. And in doing so, he did rock our world. The idea for this theme and the idea for two of the installments come from joint meetings of the American Astronomical Society and the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. They were held in St. Louis the first week of June. We're going to kick the show right off with our first installment, which is The Telescope Changed Everything. This is from Deva Sobel. Deva is a celebrated science writer and the best-selling author of the books Longitude and Galileo's Daughter. She became an expert on the life and the science of Galileo Galilei after finding a letter from his daughter, who was a nun at a convent near Galileo's home. And Deva learned to see the man not as someone who was fighting against the church, but more as a devoted father and a devoted Catholic, who nonetheless saw things that did rock the world. Deva Sobel was in St. Louis in early June to receive an award from the Astronomical Society of the Pacific for a lifetime of contribution to public knowledge and appreciation of astronomy. The award was given while some 1,000 astronomers and astronomy educators were gathered for their summer conference. So this installment is from Deva, from her special presentation to the conference. And we're going to join the presentation, in which she has some slides she'll reference. And she's going to, as we join it, she'll be describing some of the many incredible things that Galileo saw with his telescope. He saw and he drew with some impressive artistic skill the moon, Venus, and the sun. He recognized the differences between stars and planets, mountains on the moon, and he recognized spots on the sun. All these observations really changed everything because the heavens were no longer as people had thought. And people were not at the center. The Dutch invented the telescope, Deva said, but it was Galileo who changed everything because he used it to look at the sky, as Deva says.
And he was able to see that planets look different from stars, that at the time planets were just called wandering stars and the other stars were fixed stars. But through the telescope, the planets revealed themselves to be little disks, little globes, whereas the stars remained points of light, and he realized that they must be much, much farther away. And he was able to look at the Milky Way and resolve it into an enormous conglomeration of stars. And this is a section of the Belt and Sword of Orion, and his point here was, when you look through the telescope, suddenly, Orion has 500 more stars than you thought it had. And in this section alone, there were about 80 stars that no one had identified individually before. These are his field notes from his most earth-shattering discovery of all, namely the moons of Jupiter. And he was first drawn to these because he saw these three bright little stars lined up by the planet Jupiter in a straight line. And even though he was sure they were fixed stars, there was something about their brightness that called his attention. And as he watched them over a period of days, he said he moved from doubt to astonishment, to have to admit that they were actually new wandering stars. And these observations track the moons not only night to night, but sometimes hour by hour. And his calculations of them, his understanding of their periods, was really very close to modern values. And this was the discovery he tried to apply to the longitude problem. Made thousands of observations trying to use the moons of Jupiter to help sailors find their longitude. but it wasn't a very good method for that. So he decided to present them to the Medici Grand Duke. And this was how he got his position with the Medici court, by giving these new discoveries to the city of Florence and Prince Cosimo. And in the report he wrote about the discoveries, he called them the Cosmian stars. And he thought that would be a great way to get in good with Cosimo. But Cosimo wrote back that he didn't really like that name because it was vague. You know, people could think Cosmos. They could have just been the heavenly stars. So he wanted them to be called the Medicean stars. And of course, Galileo had to comply, but that also meant that he, since he had already started printing his book, he had to paste little pieces of paper in all 500 copies, changing Cosmian to Medicean. This is, of course, how we know them today. Today we call them the Galilean satellites of Jupiter. He didn't get to name many of his inventions, including the telescope, which I've already admitted was not really his invention. He called it a spyglass, or a perspicillum in Latin. He also called it a lens, and it wasn't till he was celebrated at a banquet recognizing his achievements that one of the other guests came up with the name telescope. There was also a suggestion of uranoscope, but telescope won out, of course, and that is what we call it today. And the news of these discoveries at a time when news didn't go faster than a messenger on horseback, this discovery actually made Galileo famous in his lifetime, world famous. It spread like fire, and it really did change things. This is another drawing of Galileo's, of his sunspot observations, again showing his skill. And I used to think that Galileo had blinded himself by his observations of the sun, but he was much too smart for that. He knew to let the sun's light fall through the telescope tube onto a piece of paper where he could trace the outlines of the spots. And it's charming to think that it's still done that way today at Mount Wilson. You know, they have that image and they draw them in pencil every day. Of course, people were very disturbed by this finding as well. I mean, it was bad enough to have moons of Jupiter, which lent credence to Copernicus's crazy idea that the Earth was not the center of the universe. People had clung to that because no one could figure out the dynamics of how the Earth could circle the Sun while the Moon was circling the Earth. But once Jupiter was shown to have four moons circling, then it was clear that bodies could be in motion with other bodies around them. And some people refused to look through the telescope. There was an aura of devilry about the instrument, and talk of some kind of magical instrument that would allow people to see far away had been in the air, really, since probably since the 3rd century BC, when there was that famous lighthouse at Alexandria, the Pharos, and people told stories about how that lighthouse could see ships 50 days before they sailed in. And not only could they be seen, but a great burning mirror could destroy enemy ships. And then from the 13th century on, people had spectacle lenses that allowed the scholarly to continue reading long after their youthful eyesight had failed them. And so when Galileo actually began observing the heavens with this, not what his neighbors were doing, not enemy troops, but the heavens, it really had a tremendous impact. And the same people who had refused to believe that there were moons around Jupiter wanted to believe them when the sunspots argument came up, because to say that the perfect surface of the sun was marred by these irregular spots was really more than some could bear. And so now people were ready to say that perhaps there were these new wandering stars around the sun also, and that's actually what the sunspots were just little satellites in the way. But no. Because he believed in Copernicus's sun-centered model of the cosmos, Galileo had the idea to try to observe Venus to see if it showed phases. He could tell that Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn always looked like a globe, but he reasoned that Venus should show phases. And these are his observations. And when he saw that, he wanted to let people know that he'd made the discovery, but he hadn't had time yet to really think about it and publish something with the benefit of thought. So he wrote an anagram that would let him claim the discovery without having to really come forward and talk about it. And so this is it. In the green, the red is the actual message. And it says that the mother of loves imitates the shapes of Cynthia being the moon. So, in other words, Venus has phases just like the moon. So he scrambled the letters around to make the green message, which says something very vague. I'm going to read it to you. These premature from me are at present deceptively gathered, or these unripe matters are brought together by me in vain. So he sent this around to several people to see if anybody could figure it out, and the only person who took the challenge and wrote back with a solution to the anagram was Kepler. Is Kepler here tonight? He's been walking around too. Yes, I salute you. So Kepler's solution is in blue, and he has interpreted this to mean that Galileo has discovered a red spot on Jupiter. Something that was a good two centuries in the future. No. The same thing happened with Saturn. Galileo was quite flummoxed by his observations of Saturn because he saw what he thought were companion bodies. Having found moons at Jupiter, it was logical to expect moons at Saturn. But these moons did not move. They were very large, and they stayed in place, but over a course of years, they could disappear and then reappear. And he never did figure out what they were, but he did want to get this point about the three bodies across. So another anagram, and the red part, his message says, "I have observed the highest planet to be triple-bodied." Saturn was, of course, the outer limit of the solar system. And this time, he didn't try to make another phrase out of it. He just scrambled the letters into some nonsense. That's what you see in green. And again, Kepler came back with a very inventive solution, which was that Galileo had discovered two moons of Mars. You know, another amazingly prescient idea on Kepler's part. And Kepler had kind of been waiting for this to happen because he thought that since Earth had one moon and Venus had none, Jupiter had four, Mars must have two, that there was some kind of mathematical progression going on. And then he further reasoned that since the moon was for our enjoyment, if there were four moons at Jupiter, there was a lot of enjoyment to be had, and probably Jupiter was inhabited. This is something that Galileo saw but did not really see. This must have been one of his, of course, he never knew what he missed here, but you will appreciate it. This drawing is from the series of the Jupiter moons drawings, and up in the corner is something he has labeled a fixed star. And he drew it in twice, in December 1612 and January 1613, except it isn't a fixed star. It's Neptune. Not even Uranus, Neptune. You know, more than two centuries, again, ahead of himself. But he didn't recognize what it was. He did a few things wrong, I must admit. His idea of the tides was wrong because he couldn't accept that the moon would have any influence on the tides. He thought that was a ridiculous idea, something akin to astrology, you know, that there'd be some sort of mystical influence at a distance, and he rejected it totally. All of you, or most of you, work at observatories that boast fantastic equipment, I'm tempted to say beyond Galileo's wildest dreams, except that Galileo had a very good sense of where he stood in the course of discovery. After his terrible ordeal, the heartbreak of the trial at Rome, he managed to write another book, the Dialogue on the Two New Sciences. And in that book, he said, "There will be opened a gateway and a road to a large and excellent science, into which minds more piercing than mine shall penetrate to recesses still deeper."
You're listening to an encore edition of Yin Radio, the father of the telescope.
Galileo's head was on the block. Crime was looking up the truth. And as the bombshells of my daily fears explode, I try to trace them to my youth. And then you had to bring up reincarnation over a couple of beers the other night. And now I'm serving time for mistakes made by another in another lifetime. How long till my soul gets it right? Can any human being ever reach that kind of light? I call on the resting soul of Galileo. I never could. that's all I've got to say. Cause maybe you squandered big bucks in your lifetime. Now I have to pay. But then again, it feels like some sort of inspiration to let the next life off the hook. Or she'll say, look what I had to overcome from my last life. I think I'll write a book. How long till my soul gets it right? Many human beings never reach the highest light, except for
installment number 2 on our Father of the Telescope show here for Yin Radio. This one's called 400 Years of the Telescope. It features Chris Koenig, edited by Christy Schwartz and myself. This is about the documentary, 400 Years of the Telescope. It's going to air on PBS early next year. Chris Koenig, a partner with Interstellar Media, produces and directs the show. Chris loves astronomy, and he's a video producer from the ground up. His work has taken him all over the world, including most of the major observatories in the Western Hemisphere. Chris is also founder and director of one of the most successful community observatories and the nation's only outdoor planetarium in the country. His expertise in camera work, interviewing, lighting, editing, and production management is apparent in a 10-hour PBS telecourse called Astronomy, Observations and Theories, for which he won 2 Emmy Awards in 2005. Those Emmys were for instructional programming and outstanding non-news writer. His footage has been seen in National Geographic productions, and his astrophotography graces the covers of nationally acclaimed astronomical textbooks, and it appears in various publications and videos as well. I caught up with Chris Koenig at the astronomy meetings in St. Louis in early June, and we talked about his upcoming production, 400 Years of the Telescope. Chris Koenig, thanks for talking to me today.
Not a problem. Thanks for asking.
So on the documentary, are we starting kind of with Galileo?
Actually, you start with a guy named Edwin Hubble and a telescope called the 100-inch up at Mount Wilson. And we kind of set up there because it's a good middle point to launch from in both directions. And so we're able to move the story through that point.
And where have you had to go to get shots related to your story that you're telling? All over the world?
We've been all over the world. We're going back on the road this year. We just got a National Science Foundation Award, and that's going to allow us to basically now take this 1-hour finished cut and turn it into a program that we actually not tape in just high definition cameras, but we're going to go to 4K cameras, which allows the whole program to go out onto IMAX. And so we're going to actually go back to these great places I'm about to tell you. We filmed in Assetri in Italy in the Galileo's home, reenactments of Galileo. We've been to Middelburg in Holland. We've been to Paris. We've been to Cambridge. We've been to La Palma, off the coast of Africa, to the observatories there, the Gran Canaria Telescope. We've been to Chile, to Cerro Tololo Intercontinental Observatory. We've been to Las Campanas, which is part of the Carnegie Observatories. We've been to Paranal. We have been to a new site called ALMA at 16,000 feet. We were actually taping up there, which was a unique experience for the crew as well as for a person that we're interviewing because it's so thin air up there.
Were there any incidents with the thin air? People have to take deep breaths every once in a while?
Catherine Cesarski, who's the president of the International Astronomical Union, great lady. Was up there, and actually we were trailing her a little bit, and we did really well. There's some high pressure, high oxygen areas within this where we were shooting, so we could get in and back into an oxygen environment to bring up O2 levels again. But it was a lot of fun, and we got down the hill 10,000 feet, and Catherine beat us all in ping pong. So the crew didn't show very well that day. But
you were carrying equipment, right?
Yeah, that's our excuse. Okay. That'll work.
You've got to have an excuse. Yeah.
But one of the great, asking what about great things that happened on the road and earlier, and the greatest thing was that we got to shoot Galileo's telescope, the actual telescope, at the Museum of Science in Florence. And we had made arrangements 6 months out to make this taping, and it was when the museum was closed, and they opened up the Lexan case, and they pulled the telescope out, and they finally, dusted off, brushed it very carefully, and we videotaped it, and we were all kind of holding our breath as we're doing this because nobody wanted anything to go wrong with the telescope. And the curator at that time, as we got done shooting, turns to me and asks if I would like to look through the telescope. So this telescope had been sealed probably for 10 years, who knows, when the last time it was open. And so the crew actually got to look through the telescope, and that was just a great experience. Yeah. And the whole crew at Interstellar Studios were all astronomers. So we were writing this program from our heart, and that just was just amazing. Yeah. So
the original eyepieces?
The original telescope.
I mean, things that he ground?
The telescope that he built and gave to the Medici, yes. Wow. And so we, not a dry eye in the house when it was done. It was a very, very cool experience.
What does that telescope look like? I know we're going to get to see it.
You'll see it. It's about a yard long. It's made out of a paper tube, so it's not perfectly cylindrical. It's got some bumps. It was ornately painted. And there's these two small pieces of glass, one at each end, that he then cut a mask on. So if you can imagine, a quarter would be the size of the lens, and then you take a dime and lay it over a quarter, the actual area that's a clear aperture is about the size of a dime. And he did that to correct for the errors in the optics and also the color correction. And when you look through it, it takes you a moment because one famous description was by Al Van Helden, who says it's like looking at a small glass window at an end of a straw. Because when you first look in there, you're not quite sure what you should be looking at, because you see nothing but black and then this little tiny speck of light, which then you realize is the end of the telescope. But it's neat. I got to see a cypress tree across the River Arno from the observatory, or from the museum. So it was a neat thing.
Yeah, that's cool. Let me talk to you just a little bit about, filmmaking and or Interstellar Studios.
Okay.
You've been making films?
I got into, we're doing some multimedia back in the mid-90s. I worked for the National Observatory. I was running the Kitt Peak Visitor Center. And I was basically, the press officer for the mountain. So folks would come to us and we'd set them up. And so through that process, we had the Today Show out for 5 weeks straight for Comet Hill Bop. And that was my first initial exposure to doing some photography. I'd been doing still photography most of my life. And so I got exposed to that there. Some of that carried over and some things I did after the National Observatory. But in 2002, I was approached to be a consultant on a PBS documentary, which is actually not a documentary. It's a telecourse. It's a 10-hour college telescope course that maybe some of your viewers have taken the class at their local community college or university. It's called Astronomy Observations and Theories. I was hired as a consultant, quickly became the writer, from the writer to associate producer, cinematographer, on to actually being the producer at the end of the project. Mm-hmm. And I haven't looked back since. I love it. We try to only do astronomy programming, but we've just recently, this weekend, will air in Northern California a program that we did called Hey Bum, Get a Job, which is a look at homelessness in our small town in Northern California and the complexities of it and the importance of not just looking at every person that's homeless as a drug addict or somebody that's mentally ill. It's a very complex problem, and we spent a year working on that project in parallel to this project.
What job is your favorite job of all these? I mean, it sounds like you have a hand in all of it. This is pretty much your baby.
I'm part of the whole team all the way across.
Front end production, pre-production, production. Do you like the camera work?
I love doing the camera. I got to be honest. I really love the camera work. I do still time lapses, which tonight when you see the trailer, I think you'll see some unique things that we bring to the camera through these time lapses. I enjoy doing that, but I love the whole process. I mean, it's like asking a cook, what do you like, mixing, or do you like putting the frosting on, or do you like to watch the bread rise? I mean, it's a whole process, and it's a journey, and I like the journey. The last project we spent 3 years doing, or 2.5 years doing 10 hours. The result of that was 2 Emmys, one for writing and one for production. And I think that is, again, that was an astronomy-based program, and that is a work of passion, again. And I think that shows through in our work.
It's a labor of love, but it is something that pays in the way for most people.
We are paying salaries and making a living and putting back in our little community as well as putting back into the bigger community of the world, yes. Yeah,
that's kind of a rare blessing to be able to make money at what you love to do.
Yeah. I'll let you know if I make money in about a year.
At least you get to eat.
Get to eat and travel in the meantime for the bankruptcy.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time, Chris.
Oh, thank you.
That interview was recorded last year, and that film that we talked about, 400 Years of the Telescope, is now available at PBS and through the website, www.400years.org. You can find it on your PBS station. Take a look at the schedule there.
Got a blue telescope. I'm looking at the world tonight through a blue telescope. I wish I may, wish I might not see what I see. Sheet metal on sheets of ice. Looking through this blue telescope down a moonstruck road tonight. Blue breath on my windshield. I came to a frozen place. She shivered when I said goodbye. I wish I didn't have to face her in that rearview mirror. No, she lives in the heart of me. Looking through this blue telescope, I guess she'll always be a star to me. The
Thanks for joining me for this encore edition of Yin Radio. The topic is the father of the telescope. This comes from last year, right around now at Father's Day. Down a moonstruck road tonight. father of the telescope, is our topic today. Here's our third and final installment, Galileo and Me. It's by me. I first met Galileo when I was an intern at the Kennedy Space Center. I was going to college with some hope of finishing. Finally, at age 27, I had found a program that just might hold my interest long enough that I could get a degree in space science at a small private science and technology school near the Space Coast, Florida Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Florida. It was 1985, and space shuttles were going up regularly. We didn't yet know that they were fallible. You could get a pass to watch a launch at any time, or at least to get a good view from the beaches. Or you could just skip class and watch from the lawn.
It looks good. It's a beautiful launch. Everything is gold. It looks good so far. Rising into the clear blue Florida sky.
Still, finishing school was hard for me, and I had to trick myself into finishing. One thing that I could do was take a 45-minute drive up to the Space Center and spend half a day touring the Visitor Center, just like a kid. I'd gaze in awe at a capsule that had returned from the moon, so small to hold three guys. I finished my old standard places, the Rocket Garden, for instance, with a redstone rocket that launched satellites, and launched a monkey, and launched Alan Shepard. He was America's first. And an Atlas rocket, which was John Glenn's ride into orbit, and it's still a workhorse for satellites. And there was a Titan, which you could see go up every few months or so. And even a shuttle, which was dwarfed by the huge Saturn rocket, which was too tall to display standing up, so it was laid on its side in the Rocket Garden. The IMAX films made me cry every time. It didn't matter which story was being told, because they were all stories of dreams and perseverance and danger and teamwork and incredible achievement. Remembering them now, I want to revisit one right now and cry again. After seeing one of these, I'd go back, reinvigorated and reengaged, and I would tackle my studies with gusto. During one particularly rough time, though, I had to try a bigger trick on myself. I signed up for a full semester up at the Space Center, taking an internship at Kennedy Space Center in the facilities group. It was a job I was lucky to get because the engineers at the Cape, in every unit, didn't really want to touch a space science major. It was clear what to do with a mechanical engineer or an electrical engineer or any kind of engineer. Physicists, they knew what to do with those guys, even business majors. But these space science people, half of whom were girls, what were they? Astronaut wannabes? The students in traditional majors labeled us space cadets, and it was a label we gladly adopted and we even reveled in it. But it didn't help us land jobs. Lucky for me, the KSC Facilities Management Group hadn't filled out one of the internship slots that they had that semester, so the manager reluctantly accepted my argument that space science majors could obviously do any kind of engineering. After all, we had statics, we had dynamics, fluid mechanics, straight out of mechanical engineering department. We had electronic fields and circuits, straight out of electrical engineering department. And not to mention that the math and physics was equal to, if not surpassing, all of them. We were super geeks. So the boss hired me, assigned me to simple civil engineering projects, and took me on site to look at one of my first projects. It was out at Hangar K. It needed a new door, my project, because it was being retrofitted to handle the shuttle Centaur. That's where I first met Galileo. Now, as space cadets, always knew what missions were on the drawing board and at least generally knew what was going to go up in the near future. And Galileo was one of the major spacecraft. It was ambitious as a mission as we ever launched, and it was going to go to Jupiter and it was going to look at its moons. I knew about all this in the abstract. It was something cool that was really likely to, that would happen very likely, and I was going to hear about it and I was going to see pictures from it, but that was going to be some years later. When I walked into Hangar K, though, the relationship became personal. The old-timer who ran this hangar, by the way, they were all old-timers. They avoided retirement because they loved space exploration. So this old-timer took us around to see the door that I was supposed to get be replacing. It was a huge, but not shuttle-sized door. It was for equipment passage. And as I gawked and I showed interest, plus a little bit of knowledge, he gave me the full background. Although I really think all he needed was an audience, and a young female audience was a plus, especially a young female who looked at his work, if not at him, with twinkling eyes. He explained that the hangar was going to be where the Centaur, which was a powerful upper stage booster, would be fitted into the space shuttle. The Galileo spacecraft, one of those really big ones, it needed lots of boost to get into orbit. The shuttle could get it into orbit, but then it had to be blasted way out past that, as only the really big rockets could do. The Centaur would deploy from the shuttle, and when it was safely separated from that shuttle, it would blast Galileo on its way to Jupiter. This was a big new test for shuttle operations. It would potentially eliminate the need for any more big rockets ever. I don't even remember doing that project, fixing the door, that is. I just remember the hangar and that bold shuttle Centaur Enterprise. And I remember Galileo, which was going to my favorite planet, Jupiter. It was the planet I did my project on, back when we first learned about planets in the fourth grade, with a giant planet with a big red spot. So after that, I really got into my job at KSC. The new shuttle areas were off limits to us interns, but all I cared about were the old places anyway. Each old-timer I ran into had stories to tell and places to show me. Like when I had a project to paint a parking lot, I had to paint stripes on for where the cars went. I had to meet the painter. Now, he should have retired years ago, but he was having too much fun traipsing around the ruins of this place that he had helped to build. And this place from where that he helped, that's where it all started. We had to drive to that parking lot that needed painting. And from there, we could see a multi-story building sticking up. It was rusty and it was unused, way above the sand flats and the palm trees. That's where they would run when he was young, to watch the launches, he told me. He points to the tower at the climb that they climbed that goes up to the roof. It's a totally illegal activity. Many launches were secret, he explains. Not the manned ones, but so many other satellites and tests were being launched. And you only learned that something was going up at the last minute. So you could clear out and go watch it. Or you could stop your work and climb up a ladder mounted on the outside of the tallest building near you and watch there and feel it. From that proximity, you can feel a launch deep in your bones because it rumbles and it booms. It shakes at such a deep frequency that you feel the sound down deep in your chest, and it comes to you straight from the air, a pure physical vibration that just massages your body. And then it comes up your legs from the ground. It's a mini earthquake. It climbs up to you and into you, and then the windows rattle. And if you keep your jaw slack, your teeth might even chatter. Now, they never got fired for climbing that ladder. And if they were even caught, it was just ignored. But after the parking lot needing the paint job, the old timer, after we got to that parking lot, that old timer took me back to our offices, but he went via the coast. He pointed to the lighthouse, which was now well inland, and to the shore where it used to be. After that lighthouse wasn't needed anymore, they moved it in so that they could protect it from the elements. One of the few things that was simply not simply destroyed or abandoned in place. But from this location, over the water, the Snark missiles were launched in the old days. The Snark was a quick startup program of rockets. They were called missiles back in the early days, and they were being tested like all rockets are. Many Snarks failed. So many, in fact, that it was well known that these were called snark-infested waters. He loved to tell that story. We rode up the coast to the old bunkhouses where manned missions were launched. Most were abandoned, but occasionally one would be in use, retrofitted for some purpose, usually a strange purpose that required electromagnetic shielding or isolation for sound. These were domed structures with thick walls and no windows. The single entry faced opposite the associated launch site so that flames from the launch that could sear a door wouldn't get the rest of the bunkhouse. The internship was filled with tours and explorations. If I would listen, and I did, the old gentleman would always offer a story or two and a tour if time allowed, and it usually did. On my own, I'd drive past my work site and look around a bit. If the young engineer that worked with me was traveling along with me, I was emboldened, and we went further, onto dirt roads, onto the shore, on foot, around abandoned sites, and to the old Air Force rocket garden. Sometimes we went to Alan Shepard's launch site just for a picnic lunch. When the internship was nearing its end, I got on a project to retrofit an old bunker so it could be used as a clean room. Now, I'm not really sure if it was my project. I don't remember clearly. But it was a pretty big project for an intern, so probably it was really my engineer buddy's friend, and she drugged me along with her. But I do remember what the project was for. It was the clean room that was to house the Galileo spacecraft while it was prepped for launch on the shuttle Centaur. So I had another brush with the famous Galileo. Well, I didn't finish up that project, or I didn't even really see it get started seriously. But I know what happened to Galileo. Shortly thereafter, the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up. In front of our faces, after we had become so complacent that even manned launches didn't cause drivers to pull over and watch from the roadside. The ramification to Galileo? Not only were the shuttle launches on hold, but there was no way a powerful, fuel-laden Centaur upper stage was going to go up in a shuttle whenever it did get back into business. Galileo was grounded. When you're trying to get up to Jupiter, being grounded is a major deal. You can't just go up any time. It has to be a time when the planets are aligned, literally. Everything has to be in just the right position so that you can actually hit your target. Now, this wasn't Galileo's first delay. The spacecraft, which was conceptualized in 1977, was first scheduled for launch back in 1982. Delays in space shuttle schedules caused the schedule to slip until 84, and all the while, budget cuts threatened to kill the program altogether. More slips in the schedule than a launch date of 86 was set, and that was seeming to hold. And things were looking good. And then the Challenger accident. The outlook was bleak for a few years. Galileo was finally launched in 1989 when the space shuttle was put back into operation. But the booster that would take it from shuttle's Earth-hugging orbit to its destination deep in the solar system was much, much weaker than that mighty Centaur rocket. To make this low-power rocket work and to use the planetary alignment that was given to the scenario a couple years later, Galileo had to be sent on a circuitous route around Venus and Earth so it could pick up speed and slingshot its way to Jupiter. It takes 6 years to get there. So while Galileo traveled, most of us space cadets kind of forgot about it and went back to business. I cheered for each shuttle that went up safely and watched intently, because now we knew that accidents can happen. My mind turned back to Galileo, along with the rest of my spacey friends, by the discovery of a comet. It was 94. It was a broken comet. It was made of many pieces that were whisking through space together. And it was getting ready to crash into Jupiter. Not only was it going to impact Jupiter, but it was discovered by the man who had first realized that craters are caused by impacts, Eugene Shoemaker. Gene was the only geologist to push the idea that impacts caused the craters on the moon and many of the craters on Earth. Most people thought all craters were volcanic, and his theories were pretty well accepted by 1994, and an impact was seen as a factor at least ages ago during the moon's formation. Few people really thought it was likely in modern times. Until Gene Shoemaker, along with his comet-hunting team of his wife, Carolyn Shoemaker, and his friend, David Levy, found this comet. I have some audio of Carolyn Shoemaker and then Gene Shoemaker, and then mostly you'll hear David Levy describing that discovery night in a National Geographic program that's called Asteroids, Deadly Impact.
I started to examine the film, looking at all the things that I knew would be there, the ghost image of Jupiter and the spikes from that we see on the films when we've got a very bright star or a bright planet. And then I started to go by something, and I thought, that's a galaxy? No, that's not a galaxy. and here was this most unusual-looking object. And I thought, it looks like a comet.
It looked like a comet, all right, except it was a comet that was stretched out. Our films don't have enough resolution to really see what the details are, because we're covering a big area of the sky, and so the comet's actually quite tiny.
The team called their friend, astronomer Jim Scotty, who was manning a more powerful telescope, and asked him to check their finding. He promised to call back as soon as his telescope could be repositioned.
Well, by now, it's about 2 hours that has gone by. And then I decided the time had come. Jim had had enough time to take a look, and I called Jim Scotty, and he answered the phone in a voice that I had never heard before. And I said, Jim, are you okay? And he says, yes. David, the sound you heard is me trying to pick my jaw off the floor. And I said, do we have a comet? And he said, boy, do you have a comet. And he started describing what he saw. And I was repeating everything to the two of you. And every sentence, it had these five tails, at least five discrete nuclei. But he said, I think there's more. And meantime, that music, we had just had Beethoven's first symphony that was playing in our room, just happened to be on. And the fourth movement started, and it starts with this very slow little introduction. As Jim said, boy, do you have a comet? Then the symphony went into its full motion. And then right at that point, Jim says, boy, do you have a comet?
The comet, essentially an asteroid with a long tail of dust and gas, had been torn into several pieces by Jupiter's gravity.
The big news that it was going to hit Jupiter didn't arrive until about 6 weeks later.
That was Gene Shoemaker with that big news that the pieces of the comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 were aimed at Jupiter and set to collide within a year. As I said, it was 1994, and Galileo was getting close to Jupiter. All its systems were shut down. It was conserving energy for the six-year trip. So Galileo got an early wake-up call. By impact time, the spacecraft was coming around the edge of Jupiter so that it could see part of this backside of the planet, where the comet would be hitting. It began its mission early and caught incredible pictures of an incredible, once-in-a-million-year event. After that, I got busy with my career, though. I had just moved to Moscow for a job at the University of Idaho. As a fundraiser at the College of Engineering, I only touched on space-related stuff once in a while, when I was lucky. Like when I met the guy who was the project lead for Galileo's wind experiment, who's an electrical engineer at the university. Or when I got to help students get an experiment flown on NASA's zero-G plane, the Vomit Comet. And of course, I went along with them. But mostly I was meeting alumni over meals and wine and keeping my attention on endowments, scholarship funds, and annual funds. After about 4 years of this, I had to get another taste of space. So I took up some courses, thinking I might work toward a master's degree. I was still trying to figure out what to study at a university with limited physics courses and no astronomy. In geology, I found an answer: planetary geology and geophysics. Data and images have been coming in from Galileo for years now, and Galileo is making Europa famous. Europa is one of Jupiter's moons, one of the four major moons of Jupiter, first discovered by Galileo the Man in 1610. Europa was hot because it was covered in ice, water ice, and if there's water, there may be life. Not long into my studies, I ran across a young, new professor who was going to apply his skills in structural geology to Europa. Europa's fame, and along with that, the NASA money that made it available, that was available to learn more about Europa, drew Simon Kattenhorn in, and soon I stumbled across his path. Shortly, I had a project to review images of Europa from Galileo and note all the areas with certain kinds of ridges that Simon was studying. Now, I'll try to avoid all the gory details here, but suffice it to say that I ended up studying Europa too, and turning it into a master's degree in geophysics. Galileo and Europa became well known to me. At the time, I knew all the basics of each pass that Galileo made around Europa. I knew all the types of topography, regions lined by ridges, cut by immense curving lines, jumbled in chaotic terrain. I made calculations about ridge height and weight, and I followed Shoemaker's footsteps into impact studies, looking at impacts on ice-covered lakes on Earth and comparing them to images of Europa. It took me 5 years with stops along the way, but I finally got that degree at the end of 2004. Galileo was gone by the time I graduated. I don't know how I missed that ending, but it was the spacecraft that was given a fiery end by mission planners. We knew it was coming, and I stood ready to mourn its passing, but somehow it passed me by. Galileo made many fantastic discoveries. The one that killed it was Europa's icy surface and the thought that the ocean under the ice might harbor the beginning of life. And if any contaminant, biological or chemical, survived Galileo's 14 years in space, it might plunge into Europa and destroy what was growing there, or just change what was happening. So instead, NASA decided to send Galileo on a collision course with Jupiter so that, just like Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9, it would impact the planet it orbited for so long. On September 21, 2003, after 14 years in space and 8 years in and among Jupiter and its four Galilean moons, Galileo, the spacecraft, terminated its mission. Now, I know I'm never going to go back and get a PhD. Maybe that's because there's no Galileo to inspire me to keep working on it. At least that's an excuse I can always use. The truth is, Galileo still inspires me. I really just don't like school very much.
When he looked into a starry sky upon Jupiter, let's call.
This has been an encore production of Yin Radio from last year.
Show. This is Sandy Billings. I'd like to thank Christy Schwartz for helping with the production on this show and Danny Vargas for musical assistance. Dave Sobel, Chris Koenig helped provide today's show. And I'm your producer and host from KRFP in Moscow, Idaho. This is Yin Radio. Until next week.
Was Mercury in retrograde? But he found the truth when a lie was what was demanded. When the judges asked him pointedly, he was a tremble.